Welcome to the upstreamlife.com. I'm Vishal Krishna, and I'm its founder and editor. But let me tell you one thing. I love people who travel. People who travel the world, meet founders, help companies come to India, go out of India. I've got Shaurya with me. Shaurya is the founder of Breathe Capital and Cap Connect. Shaurya, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. I'm a founder of Breathe Capital and Cap Connect. We work with founders to raise capital, help them on M&A on the Cap Connect side, and on the Breathe Cap side, we invest in founders building in the seed, Series A stage in India and Southeast Asia.
So watch this podcast, and I will put you in touch with them. I'll put in the links of the website, and thanks, Shaurya.
Thanks, Vishal.
Thank you. Yeah. Shaurya, thank you for joining me on the podcast. You know, I've always been interested in understanding Indonesia, Singapore, Philippines, and it's heartening to know that somebody who's lived there is here in my studio today to tell me about the startup ecosystem, the HNI ecosystem, the NRI ecosystem. Obviously, you're the founder of, co-founder of Breathe Capital and Cap Connect. Tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, it's always interesting to know how people transition into these things. Did you always want to be this investor or this financial guy, you know, doing iBanking?
I mean, I don't know where it starts. First of all, thank you for having me on the podcast. I don't know where it starts, where you want to start being a certain thing, but I guess one thing leads to another. I was born and brought up in Delhi. I was chose to go to Singapore because it was, you know, close by, financial hub, seemed like a good place. Again, very, I guess, accidental, right? Your parents thought it's a good place. You didn't mind it, so you end up there. So I spent about, you know, 3 years studying there. And I absolutely love the place, and it's been over almost 10 years now, and I've just, you know, been living there. Why finance? I guess, you know, it's, again, I did a business degree with a major in finance, and, you know, I liked it. I liked the job profiles people were doing, you know, whether working with money on the public side or the private side. So that was always exciting. As a kid, you know, you get influenced by either your seniors or, you know, your uncle and aunts who are doing certain things, or even movies, etc. So you know, go in that path. And when I actually started doing it myself, I absolutely loved it, right? So yeah,
that's how it happened. So it's interesting, right? You come from an entrepreneurial family?
Absolutely.
And that must have rubbed off.
So I'm actually the first person in my family to do a job. My mom's an entrepreneur, my dad's an entrepreneur, my brother's an entrepreneur. So even though I did do a job for the first 5 years of my career, it was always like I have to run my own thing, right? Because I've seen them build their businesses, go through, you know, a lot of failures, but also go through a lot of successes. And those are just moments which I wanted to have for myself as well. I knew that starting an entrepreneurial career in finance from the get-go is almost next to impossible. But if you work at a decent enough place, you get the right experience, you get the right people around you, you can eventually launch something of your own.
I'm glad you said right people. That's where, let's start with the iBanking business and then move to the VC business that you do. I think meeting people in Singapore, your other co-founders, has helped you get some great deals in Singapore, in Vietnam, right, Philippines, right? And if you looked at the numbers, you've raised anything from 10 million to 100 million for many of those startups. Mm. Talk me through that journey of meeting the right people.
Well, I mean, I think it starts from you first. You can't predict who's going to come into your life, but you can control what you're going to do and how you're going to be and what your values are, right? And I think eventually that attracts the right people around you. So I think it's I've been very lucky, I would say, to have the right mentors from the get-go, have, you know, very good partners who chose to partner up with someone who is relatively young. Like, I started Cap Connect when I was 27 years old, right? That's a fairly young age.
But you did it with a nice gentleman. Chris is your co-founder,
Chris,
and there's one more
right.
person.
Chris was my boss in my first job, and then we built out that company together, side by side, you know, working day in, day out together. So we got, of course, very close and understood each other. Then when he said, "I'm going to set up my own company, will you be my partner?" I didn't even think twice.
Okay, that's how CapConnect came about.
Yes.
And how many founders there?
Two of us.
And two of you, right? Mm-hmm. The deals that I see on your website, you've done everything from supply chain, health tech, you've done some IoT deals. What works in a Southeast Asia context, and how is that context playing out from India? Because you told me earlier that India is a leader for Southeast Asia today. So I want to demystify that, because I thought India was always about, you know, consumer, but you're saying that there's going to be a lot of activity for India for Southeast Asia kind of play.
Well, so much, right? Well, so much. The influence of India is just increasing across. First, actually, I want to just break down what Southeast Asia is.
Please.
I'm sure a lot of people know, but just to, you know...
Please, there's a lot of people who don't know. We have to say that. A lot of people will be first-time listeners.
So Southeast Asia is, I think, about 700 million people across 6 or 7 countries with their own cultures, own languages. I think the most known countries, of course, Singapore is kind of the launch pad, the financial hub, which is its own country of 5 to 6 million people, very advanced, a developed economy, right? Then the largest country in Southeast Asia is Indonesia, which is 300 million people, spread across 17,000 islands. I think most famous Indonesia is known for Bali, but there's so much more to it, right?
Yes.
Then you've got Thailand, you've got Vietnam. Vietnam's got about 80-90 million people of its own.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not homogeneous like India is. It's 1.4 billion people, although India is...
Culturally,
India is very diverse,
complex,
as well.
Yes.
But it's one country,
yes.
Right? So I think Southeast
Asia is like Europe in a way, similar in a way. There are different countries, different cultures.
Yes.
Got it. Yes.
Yeah, a lot of similarities, but different cultures,
mm-hmm.
Right? So I mean, I think Southeast Asia, when we look at it, has to be looked at with that lens. And when I went in, of course, you know, I've spent a lot of time traveling to Vietnam, traveling to Indonesia. Jakarta is like my second or third home after Singapore and India. So we've spent that time, you know, understanding the entrepreneurs, working with them from the get-go. We started working in the... I started working with founders in 2016-17 in these countries when it was still... I mean, it was relatively advanced, but still also very nascent. Right, so I've kind of grown up with that ecosystem.
It's interesting, even 2015-16, India, apart from Flipkart and the Snap deals, was still very nascent. I think those two deals, Snap deals, unicorn status, and Flipkart's unicorn status, changed the whole game.
Yes.
From 15-16. Would you view Indonesia and other parts being the same in Southeast Asia at the time, or is it very different now? We've talked about 9 years now.
Quite identical in terms of the journey. It was always the large e-commerce B2C guys which came through,
yes.
Then the fintech guys followed. Then it was edtech, health tech, and, you know, SaaS as well, following simultaneously.
Okay.
And now it's about AI, etc. Even in Indonesia, the largest unicorns were Tokopedia, which was the Flipkart of Indonesia, right? And Lazada out of Singapore, which is the Alibaba backed. And these were the largest tech companies then. But it was about 3 years behind India, I would say 2 or 3 years behind India.
Then, in what sense?
In terms of, say, Flipkart, when it reached, as basic as when Flipkart reached its unicorn valuation,
yes.
Versus when Tokopedia reached its unicorn valuation, right?
Yes.
So it was about 3 or 4 years behind. I don't know the exact year, but it was
that
much behind. And then the fintech guys came, the lending guys came, and it was similar to India. So what we're effectively seeing, and I'll talk about Indonesia specifically,
yes.
And it's Vietnam is similar. Thailand and Malaysia is, you know, a bit different. So Indonesia and Vietnam together are kind of following India in terms of the business models. What business models are being built.
Consumer.
Consumer or, you know, even serving businesses, right? The SME, SME financing, SME tools, the SaaS platforms, etc. Because eventually the B2Bs, the businesses serve the consumers, and the consumers, that's how it evolves. So Indonesia and Vietnam are following India in terms of the business models which are being built.
Okay.
I think we spoke about this before. Today I'm sitting with a seed or a Series A Indonesian founder,
mm-hmm.
And they're like, we're building an X for Indonesia, and that X is usually an Indian company which is at a Series B or a Series C.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And so in the B2C space, B2B also?
B2B as well. I mean, you look at the procurement, B2B mm-hmm. procurement space, right? I mean, Off Business has done a great job. There are at least 5 companies at seed Series A level in Indonesia which are which are wanting to be the off business of Indonesia. Right. So that's pure B2B procurement.
So that's why India is going to be a leader, because they look at Indian talent, they look at Indian capital as well, or they just look at India as so diverse that there's a lot of business models working here.
Well, one is India is serving a much larger market and a much more mature market in terms of the digitization curve, right? And second is also it's the Indian influence, right? I mean, you see there are... In India and Southeast Asia have a lot of common pools of capital. You know, there's Indian VCs which are investing from the same capital into Southeast Asia. I mean, case in point, some of the more well-known names are Lightspeed. Lightspeed India invests. It's the same team which invests in India, invests in Southeast Asia. Right. You know, they have learnings from India, which they take to Southeast Asia. And third is it's just, you know, the migration of Indian people. There are... I don't know if this is a surprising fact. It's not to me. One in seven, at least last year, this was the stat, one in seven founders in Southeast Asia are Indian.
Okay. Right? Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, so they are carrying their learnings. A lot of them are, you know, ex-Flipkart, ex-Snapdeal, all these big companies in India, which are now building in Indonesia or Vietnam or Singapore even, right? So there's a lot of factors at play here.
Okay, so the fascinating aspect is, so you cannot ignore India in these matters. You said Filipinos are looking up to it, Indonesians are looking up to it. My concern is, do you see Indian companies going and setting up shop there, or do you see a reverse mechanism where these companies will use the talent, these Indonesian, Filipino companies will come set up shops here and say that, look, we like the talent, we'll set up, we'll acquire a startup here and probably set up a global innovation center from India for the world kind of thing. Will that happen?
It's happening already.
Okay.
It's happening, and both things are happening. I'll give you specific examples of both. Indian companies have had mixed success going into these markets, and for whatever reasons, right? I think the guys who've done well, there was... So Meesho went in. Meesho didn't do well, right? Meesho went to Indonesia, and they couldn't do well. There are other companies which have gone and done well. There's a POS company just escaping right now, Pine Labs.
Okay, yeah, Pine Labs.
Pine Labs did a decent job in Malaysia, you know, still like kind of powering through into Southeast Asia. Lenskart is in Southeast Asia, doing a decent job. So there are Indian companies already going, but I think...
So there are experiments happening at this point.
So that volume of... That's going to increase 5x in the next 5 years.
Right? And it's again the same thing. You said... The average, you made a wonderful point while we were having coffee. You said an average Indonesian teenager would be thinking like an Indian 15-year-old. And even a 25-year-old, they'd have similarities. Yeah, and that's why Indian companies are going there. And their companies are coming and using the talent pool to build for their countries.
Well, when you take, let's just take the boundaries out,
Please.
And whether it's a 25-year-old or in Indonesia, or in India, living in the metropolitan city of Jakarta, or living in a metropolitan city of Mumbai, the content they're consuming, the habits they have, the way they behave is very much similar, right? Now, you take this at a big picture, the startups which have in India, which have been serving to the premium, the first 25 million or the first 50 million Indian consumers, they are way advanced in their learnings, their business models, to serve these Indonesian consumers, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, I think that's very important.
Okay.
And the other side of it, the global innovation centers, you know, I was very very happy to see, actually. There's a EV company out of Vietnam called VinFast, which just announced opening a facility, a manufacturing facility in India. They're going to spend $1 billion. The largest companies in Indonesia, like Gojek, and all of these guys have their engineering teams.
Correct. Gojek was a well-known name here,
In Bangalore, right? And there's so much connect. There's so many Singaporean companies as well, which have, you know, Indian offices, whether serving India as a demand center or, you know, using the talent in India to build things for the world.
What a moment to be an Indian. And it's interesting. You said capital, human capital. There's all, now we haven't even gotten to what type of investments from HNIs will get there. So you're saying there's human capital, there's private capital, there is there are Indian leaders who are going to lead Southeast Asian companies, and all of them are coming together.
Yes.
So do you factor the geopolitics also, you know, before you invest or get people to invest in the companies that you bring forward?
Well, I think, I mean, we're at a brilliant time in terms of where India sits in the geopolitical landscape. I mean, we're quite friendly to Most people were welcomed at most places, and it's been a, I would say it's been a marked shift in the last 10 years, right, where we're kind of going out there and being vocal and being successful, being vocal about our success, right? I mean, and that gets noticed around. And I feel that it's a great time to be an Indian abroad at this time, because there's so much acceptance in terms of what you can do and what you, you know, you can do way more what you could do probably 10 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. I agree. That's changed. And the geopolitics also, I mean, India now talks about made in India for the world kind of concepts, manufacturing. And in that, do you see yourself looking at, sometimes do you get decks from, you know, rare earth companies or materials, you know, or things like you were mentioning nickel, for example, in Indonesia. Do you see that Indian entrepreneurs playing a role in these ownership of these commodity space? Battery recycling is a big thing. From this commodity that manufacturers, say that goes into an EV, to all the way to battery recycling, there seems to be an end-to-end player. Do you see India owning that value chain? And begins with geopolitics, yes. We need to know that journey, right? Do you see that happening?
Increasingly, although not as much, okay. we do see sprinkles of it.
Okay.
But going forward, I think it's going to increase massively. Mm-hmm. You know, on the EV space, India much less now, but a lot of these countries are flooded by Chinese EVs, right? The two-wheeler
absolutely.
EVs. And we clearly know the performance is not at par with the conventional fueled two-wheelers. Mm. But in India, we see now, and we spoke about a couple of entrepreneurs who are building two-wheelers, motorbikes, which are at par out of India, right?
Yes.
But there's going to be a learning curve there, and that will get exported out.
Just like fintech as a bubble, even this would be something similar in the EV space, where you see a lot of entrepreneurs coming in, a lot of experiments, but then you'll see these 10 companies or so survive?
Yes. I mean, that's pretty much how it goes, right? Mm-hmm. There's a pickup in a certain sector, a lot of people start building for that, and then, you know, it starts getting weaned out, and only a few survive. But I think that is how we get sharper, how the business models also get sharper. And as a consumer, that's what you want as well, right? You don't want two or three companies building in a space when your lack of options as a consumer shouldn't be there, right? You should have the best, fight it out, and the best win it.
Just a fact, you know, 1920s in America, there were 1,000 automobile companies. Now there must be, what, 4 or 5 or something of that sort, right?
Yes.
It's interesting. So that's a rule of business. Mm. So for you, when you meet, you go to different countries, do you see the geopolitics side embracing India as a business hub? Do you see those conversations happening as well?
Well, very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much mm-hmm. so. I think people are more aware of, it's not just IT mm-hmm. services we give out, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we should be very proud of the IT services, etc., what we've done in the past.
And that set the foundation.
It built so much talent, you know, decades of talent got built through that. And there was a lot of inflow of money because of that. But I think people increasingly see that's not it, right? Mm-hmm. Even when you look at the space tech side, you know, we're building here, and we're building stuff as good as some of the top players in the world.
Yes. Right? Now, I want to move into that segment. Now, you mentioned space tech. So, getting into your hat as a VC with Breathe Capital, of course, you and Zubin run it. What are some of the areas that interest you from India for Southeast Asia, Southeast Asia to India, for example? What's the kind of investment thesis does Breathe Capital carry?
So, we're not necessarily... you know, assigned to that we'll only invest in an Indian company if it's applicable to Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great benefit. And where we do see the learnings coming from India into Indonesia, into Philippines, into Vietnam, is really the agri sector, right? Because, again, I think India has more years of experience, entrepreneurs have more years of experience building in this space, you know, how to get more output with less input, how to do it in a sustainable
it's
manner.
It's becoming more organized that way.
Yes.
Agritech is in now.
Yes. And it also affects, in terms of its impact, I think volumes impact, there's no other sector, right? in terms of number of people who are involved, right?
Yeah, did you know all the horticulture produce, we don't export a lot of it. Most of it is consumed within India. Mm. Even rice, and we export some.
Yes.
But I think 95% of it is consumed within India.
Yes.
There's so much organizing to do within India's supply chain as well.
Yeah, and we have a growing young population to feed, right? So we need to, we have enough, I guess, land, but we have to increase the output from the same
resource,
right?
So less water.
Yes.
Those things interest you?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think these learnings are very applicable to developing countries. Mm-hmm. Now, a startup in US cannot be doing this, because these problems are very specific to developing countries.
Yes.
And India is a leader within the developing country space. So
EdTech, what do you think on EdTech? I mean, so much written about it. My God, so much. It's like a bloodbath in the media. Yeah. They make people and they break down people. So what are your thoughts on that sector?
I mean, I think it was a bit of an overpromise, right? There was, during the COVID period, when lockdowns were there, and talking about K-12 specifically, there's a lot of overpromise.
I was referring to K-12,
There's a lot of overpromise in terms of how much digitization, how many people, how much online learning is going to be there, and how offline is going to be taken over, and it's a real substitute online, right? And that overpromise kind of fell flat after the lockdowns finished and people started returning. People still, like physical learning. They want to go to school. At least parents like the children out of the house. We know that for sure,
that's
right?
True.
So I think, it was just, it's also a herd mentality, because if you look at the investors which backed some of the larger startups here, these aren't amateur investors, right? So you have to, some models went really wrong here, right? Yeah. So I think one thing to note specifically is, you can be the biggest name with the biggest institution. How do you escape that herd mentality, right? Because, I'm sure some of the investors saw it coming, but a lot of them didn't. Mm. Although I would say now what is left is the hybrid models, right? You see a lot of the online and offline models which are doing decently well. Mm-hmm. And it's again the same thing, right? I mean, there's going to be 10, 12 players. There's going to be one big star which kind of falls. But that the solution is still needed.
Yeah, I think it's still the problem. You're right, India is so complex that nobody should stop it. Mm. So you're saying EdTech is there to play out?
Absolutely.
It's just that there's some bad news out there.
It's not as big as you thought. And the adoption curve on the online learning which you put does not exist.
Okay, I want to quickly talk about, you like fintech, although fintech's going through a bad time as well now. Oh, your thoughts on fintech quickly?
Well, I think, it's not all fintechs are going through a bad time. It's certain fintechs which, again, business models were, I think some of the buy now, pay later guys, very unfortunate for the employees and all of that, of course. But I feel that the Indian ecosystem is large enough, they will get consumed somewhere. So coming back, I think some of the buy now, pay later guys, there was a force fit of the solution, right? And it's also promoting, what are you promoting? Buy things which you cannot afford, right? And sometimes it helps, of course, if it's a capital, if it's a large capital expenditure. So some of those models haven't done well, but I feel that certain models, even on the lending side, have kind of shown through this, even during this phase, because, they from day dot were running profitable, good unit economic businesses. So I think tech in general is struggling, because there's a bit of like reset of business fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a phase where you have to reset. Mm-hmm. And once you go through it, you will, if you did it for the right reasons, this is always exceptions, but did it for the right reasons, you will kind of, stand at the end of it as well.
So you're sector agnostic. You don't mind meeting the color of entrepreneurs, but
absolutely,
you will choose. What do you choose on? I've made mistakes in choosing based on,
all of us
background.
Have made mistakes. I think on the advisory side, earlier on, we were sometimes overzealous in terms of, taking founders out to market when they were not ready, when their business models weren't ready. But now, of course, you know, we learn from our lessons. We try to be as transparent and honest with the founders on the advisory side.
Yes.
In terms of, is there interest for your company? What kind of interest will be there? Let's go and, you know, soft sound a few of your potential investors or acquirers and see what the feedback is. And sometimes the feedback is, okay, great, let's, you know, launch. Sometimes it is, let's come back in a bit. Okay. Or sometimes it's like, you know, this model is
it's not going to fly.
It's probably you've got to run it as a standalone business and don't expect funding.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's also the scenario once. On the investment side, because we go in very early, again, quite agnostic, but there's certain sectors we understand more than others. We go in early, so it's really a large part of it is backing the founder, right?
Okay.
It's backing the founder because at a seed stage company, the business models can pivot. You know, if you're a seed stage company doing X right now at Series A, you could be doing Y, and that is completely fine.
Okay. Yes,
it's completely fine because you're in experiment stage, etc., right? And seed Series A, this is, but what you need is a founder who would, you know, one, be creative around this.
And recognize the fact that they may have to change.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Second, be flexible. And third, persistent as well, right?
Got it.
And we found that, and again, I probably fall into the younger category, but we found that the, you know, the older founders are more resilient because they've seen the business cycles. And they've gone through
multiple iterations.
They've gone through life experiences as well, right?
Multiple iterations of life experiences.
Yes.
So you're saying they're more resilient?
Yes.
Are they flexible?
Lesser so than the younger ones, but you can't get everything,
I got it. So it's a tough job. Shaurya, we've been talking resilience. You know, you told me that it's you need to invest in the founder. It's very difficult sometimes. You need to, you know, you need to be more transparent. You need to share data. You need to tell them yes and no. But then business works or doesn't work. It's an investment call. Now, I know this subject has been talked about. Everybody wants to, you know, not invest, but at least say that, are you building Gen AI? And you were right. You know, it's done to death. Everybody's talking about it. Do you believe that story? Or you should just say that, look, it's like another part to the wheel and it should be used, but it's not the business mode.
Well, I don't think it's another part to the story. It's everything, actually.
Okay. It's everything, would you say?
It's everything in terms of we don't know the extent of it, but we know it's, you know,
it's going to make it big.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be impactful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, of course, a lot of noise as well. Whenever there's money involved, eyeballs involved, there's a lot of noise. I feel that, you know, certain geographies are, in terms of where the business models are being built, are better suited to do certain things within that. So, I mean, US is, of course, very advanced from an innovation standpoint. Of course, the media will, I mean, a lot of the media paints out that, you know, it's US is on its downward spiral, but I think that is still the hub of the innovation for the world, right, in terms of the talent base they have, again, the experience which they have, and the infrastructure which is available to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think US will be the leader.
In
the space the founders building out of there will be the leader.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it is so vast and massive, this space, that there has to be localized models being built as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see in India there's Bharat GPT and all of that. I mean, outsiders can't build that, right? I think if I'm in India or if I'm in Singapore or Indonesia, I'm thinking, what should we do so we don't fall behind, right? I think, I mean, those are the thought processes which have to run through your mind. So absolutely, it's here to stay. It's here to create an impact.
I like the fact that you said Bharat GPT because imagine a citizen. I think we've done great in the UPI, Aadhaar kind of scenario. And if the Bharat GPT comes through, it's going to be very robust. And those are the kind of solutions that India will probably build, right?
Yes,
and there'll be a lot
absolutely.
Of startups building for that.
Absolutely.
And that we can't ignore, you're saying.
No, I mean, I think it needs to be done with focus and with capital. And we have to find out noise blockers. Because $1 gone to a copy-paste idea which will die out in 5 years is $1 taken to an idea which, you know.
Which could have been
made
sustainable
much more money, and impact lives.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay. Do you see, you know, a lot of people combine the Gen AI for many things, like climate tech people talk about, space tech you mentioned briefly. Do you see these industries playing out with Gen AI kind of thing?
I mean, I think all industries will be impacted. I think to the extent that it helps you operate more efficiently, operate more faster, I think it's going to be used across, right?
Yeah, so do investors appreciate it? I mean, you must be talking to several LPs, several HNIs, NRIs. Do they understand, they do know the flavor that they bring in? I mean, do they understand what's happening around the geopolitics, the technological changes that are happening?
Yes.
I'm glad you said the U.S. can be a leader here, although their politics is a bit shoddy at this point of time. Mm. They are an innovation leader, and so would be China. Mm. So, and India has now come into the fore. Mm-hmm. So do your LPs or HNIs understand these? Or do they just say that, look, I average return 7 years, 8 years, so, or 5 years or lesser? How do you handle them?
So I think they have a very good understanding of their own businesses and how the world events are impacting their businesses. A lot of the investors which we speak to are running, their own traditional industries or whatever, and they exactly know what's happening, right, and how that's going to impact. That's why they're, you know, successful and have that money to invest with us. When it comes to how it will impact our business, what are the technologies, I think they understand it on a first layer basis. A second, third layer is, of course, missing, which they rely on us to give them, right? Or which they at least rely on us to know. So we can, you know, make those decisions for them. I feel that knowing everything and not knowing something very deeply is absolutely wrong, right? So these guys, ideally, you know, there's so many learnings as well from them, because they've operated in their business. They're kind of, you know, very successful, very well known in their own industries. And there's cross applications to take, right? How do you operate? What are the, you know, business principles, etc.? So, we learn from them as much as they learn from us.
So those are the kind of people you like to bring on the table for investments, right?
Absolutely, because I mean, I think we're not in a rush in general. You know, we don't want to go and flood the market with capital, try to raise from everyone possible. Mm-hmm. We want to have good people around us who will be there with us on a, you know, sustained basis, who we can have smart conversations with, who we can have, you know, nice dinner, fun conversations as well, right? So we're not rushed.
Okay. What's the definition of micro VC? Because I was also associated with a bunch of students who at the time wanted to do micro VC, and they were successful at a certain level. They all became influencers. How would you look at a micro VC? And you call yourself one as well. You and Zubin Doop, Breathe Capital is a micro VC.
Because we're a relatively small outfit. And I think it's, one is the size of it, right? We're not an institutionalized, fully built out VC with 40 people working for us. We're effectively four partners, and Zubin and I are the main partners. So I think one is size. Which is the main kind of reason to call yourself a micro VC.
But what would your typical investment size be?
Well, it ranges anywhere from 100K to 500K. Average is about 300, 350. Uh-huh. And stage is seed, pre-series A. Uh-huh. Occasionally, we do participate in bridge rounds for larger, mature companies. With a, you know, specific... has to be a big pull to do that.
Okay. Yeah. What about debt? A lot of the founders listening in would say, you know, I've been hearing a lot of people don't want debt also. A lot of the hospitality businesses that we meet take debt to service their working capital. How do you advise, you know, tech entrepreneurs should always rely on equity, I think. But the operational business like retail, I don't know if you've ever done retail tech, retail deals, retail hospitality deals, they love debt. So what's the typical advice to a founder today who's building tech? Go for debt or raise money from family, then come to people like you?
Well, I think it's it depends on the purpose of raising the debt, right? Indian entrepreneurs, especially the smaller ones, and doesn't necessarily need to be tech, like you said, right? Could be an export business, could be a retail business. they have a massive working capital issue.
Yes.
This is a persistent problem. And there's been so much digitization on the fintech side, lending, there's so many lending players, but that opportunity has not been captured fully.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? And they struggle to get working capital debt. I mean, they have confirmed orders, invoices, and, you know, I won't name the banks, but there's large banks who were just, you know, documented to death, right? So I think absolutely take debt, but depends on the purpose of taking debt. If it's a working capital thing, I think there's not enough players who are doing that and should do it, because, you know, that will fuel, that's the fuel for these SMEs to grow, right? But when it comes to using debt for, I guess, lending as well, further lending, I think there's a lot of lending players which raise debt to further lend.
Correct.
As long as, you know, there is proper measures taken around, there's enough equity backing that up. There's the debt equity ratios that you can take debt for lending further as well.
Would you suggest the VCs, the startups, pardon me, they, when they're building tech, is it necessary to take debt at all or raise from family? And it's an age-old question, an age-old problem. It still exists.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a path, if you have a clear path of paying it, I mean, there's also revenue-based financing, right? Which is available. I mean, a lot of the founders would take debt, rightly so, is sometimes to protect the dilution, right? Because if you're getting a very, you know, aggressive valuation from a VC where you're getting diluted, can you take debt? As long as you have, you know, decent enough visibility of paying that debt back, sure.
Okay.
Because, I mean, debt can, you don't have to return equity, but you have to return debt.
Yes.
And if you don't return debt, you know, you could have just called quits on your, so you need to be very careful around debt.
Got that. SaaS is a major business. It's made India very popular, especially the Chennai crowd. You know, they have this beautiful community growing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But what do you think about SaaS now? I mean, a lot of people say vertical SaaS. A lot of people say that, okay, you can also build horizontal SaaS. That argument's being played out.
So there's
What should we go to? I mean, they thought they'll replace the Microsofts of the world in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, products from India for the world kind of thing. I've seen the long tail, the smaller companies that take these free products, but you necessarily don't see the conversions when they become larger SMEs or something. Mm-hmm. Where do you see SaaS play out for you?
Well, there's a lot of themes. I think, first of all, Zoho and Freshworks have done such an outstanding job
absolutely.
In terms of promoting Indian SaaS. So there's vertical versus horizontal SaaS, and then on the customer side, is it SME versus enterprise, right? I think on the vertical versus horizontal SaaS, there is a case to be made, there is vertical SaaS needed, but I think they've just created so many verticals now that it's becoming a bit challenging for these companies. As a user, whether you're an SME or an individual or even an enterprise, you don't want 10, 12 SaaS systems being used, right? You want
consolidation.
Yeah, you want probably 4 or 5 max and a consolidated solution which is giving you probably 80-90% of your usage.
Yeah, right? I got it.
They are building, a lot of the SaaS companies are building for use cases which are rare or will be used, say, once in a month, right? And spending their time there versus focusing on the convenience use case.
Uh-huh.
So I think, I mean, there is a case for vertical SaaS as long as you don't, you know, vertical it out too much. I don't know if that's a word.
Makes sense, though.
And then second, SME versus enterprises. I think the enterprises still like to use some of the established players.
Yeah.
And they will continue using that because the service levels, the service quality, etc. I mean, they also, a lot of the procurement guys there have to check box, right?
Yeah, the process. They're sticklers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, checking a box in Microsoft and then Microsoft failing, the procurement officer would be like, it's not my fault, it's Microsoft, right? Versus if you check, you know, if you take a startup on, then how do you justify that?
Yeah.
So I think enterprises continue using the larger tech companies and you know, there is a case to be made why they do that, service levels, etc. The startup upstart vertical guys are focusing more on the SMEs, but there's a big question mark on their paying power and their loyalty, so to say, right? I mean, how long are they going to stay with you? Are they going to jump? How much is it differentiated, your product? So, I mean, I think that's a volumes game, but if you can build a sticky product, then you can grow the cases that you can grow with these customers, right?
Mm-hmm. So it's here to stay then?
Yes, it is here to stay, but I think it has to be a differentiated
approach, because
offering.
There's so many players now.
Yes.
Yeah. But in the Southeast Asian side, do you see more for the logistics side, any particular sectors that you've liked or using SaaS, or would you just say that, look, build horizontal, it's fine, vertical later? What are you a fan of?
I mean, I think Southeast Asia, the SME digitization is not at that place yet to build very, very vertical specific mm-hmm. SaaS. I think horizontal SaaS does
Still
the
works.
Job.
Okay.
Now, I think certain enterprises pick up vertical SaaS for certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you an example, right? There's a very brilliant company in Singapore called the Stakeholder Company, TSC.ai, and it maps out the stakeholder relations for enterprises. So if you're like an Exxon who wants to enter an African country, do the business, who are the stakeholders, what is the geopolitics, etc. So that gets very specific vertical SaaS, and certain enterprises have a use for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Southeast Asia, when you talk about some of the developing economies, the SMEs aren't as ready to adopt that digitization. I think the first hit is always on the admin finance side, so anything on ERP, anything on bookkeeping, I think mm-hmm. that kind of gets the first push through. Anything else is just a luxury which a lot of these guys can't afford.
Okay, economy-wise, where are we heading? The U.S. seems to have slowed down a little bit, Europe more so. Where do you see Southeast Asian resilience happening? India's been resilient to even the last slowdown, but generally our RBI has done extremely well in terms of mm-hmm. tightening controls and making sure that we are running in, that the interest rates are controlled, that there's no consumer debt.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen from a Southeast Asian India perspective? We see a consumer play happening in a larger forefront for the next 5-6 years. Somebody told me that not 6,000 brands, but India will have 30,000 brands coming under the fore in the next 5-6 years.
Yeah.
I'm thinking the same is going to happen in Southeast Asia then.
Well, I mean, I think again, very hard to say from a region perspective, but say Indonesia, we're very bullish on. Indonesia is supported by its commodities. It has great natural resources which continue on a very successful path in terms of exports.
Yes.
Palm oil, nickel, etc. Very exciting. So I think that Indonesia is very, very interesting and will continue to grow. It's also, they've got brilliant talent there as well, which is, learning and improving. So we see Indonesia being quite bullish on Indonesia for the next 10 years. I think the tech side is slowed everywhere. Indonesia is not immune to that.
Mm-hmm.
But we do see a bounce back, probably next year. I think this year is still going to be similar or slightly more active than last year, but we don't see a lot more activity, like nowhere close to 2021, right? That's for sure, from the tech standpoint. I think India is very interesting. Also, I have to say that India and Indonesia both are going through elections this year.
Mm.
In fact, 40 countries in the world are going through elections this year, so a lot can change. So bringing it back, I think India, Indonesia, both going through elections, everyone's kind of on the fence, waiting and watching and seeing what happens. And then it can really, I think fundamentally the countries are, of course, primed to, keep growing and on a good path. It is just how fast, right?
Okay.
And the outcome of the elections will drive the velocity of the growth.
Okay.
Is what we feel. India, certain sectors are very interesting. I think there's a lot of capital going towards manufacturing, right? Smart manufacturing.
That interesting.
Industry 4.0, absolutely. But I think it's still behind. But with the right attention, focus, and capital, this is a sector which needs to be tracked very closely.
Okay. Got it.
So
the deals, how many deals do you want to do per year? as an iBanker and as a VC?
Well, we should never target the number of deals because it makes you do stupid things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially at your fund size, I agree.
Yes.
The larger funds can say we do 30 deals or something. Yes. But in your case, you're right. You want to explore as many as they come.
Yes, absolutely. And we don't mind taking the smooth and slow path because I think eventually that is the fast path.
No, great.
And even on the advisory side, we want to take it in a very selective manner, do it with the right founders. I think that matters way more than number of deals.
No, fantastic. And I wish you all the best on the business side of things. A couple of personal questions. How do you unwind in terms of you travel in Singapore, Delhi quite often?
Yeah.
Do you read a lot, spend time with family? How do you unwind?
Well, I'm lucky I get to travel a lot because of work.
Mm-hmm. And meet a lot of fantastic people,
yeah,
of course.
And,
yes.
You know, spend time with different people throughout the year. I think that's always nice. And as you work and as you live in a country, you make, you know, friends there as well. I spend a lot of time in Jakarta, Singapore, and India as well. I think traveling is a great unwinding mechanism for me. Otherwise, you know, absolutely spend time with family when I'm back home. Yeah, and, you know, like everyone does, watch Netflix, read some books.
What's your favorite book of late or a movie that you liked of late?
I just finished Matthew McConaughey, who's a Hollywood actor.
Yes, very famous one.
Who's much more than an actor, actually. You know, he's kind of an actor philosopher. His autobiography called Green Lights.
He's building something, isn't he?
He's always up to something, but his autobiography is called Green Lights, and it's about, you know, his life journey, but it's also about how he saw green lights in things which, you know, are seemingly not green lights, and took that and built from there, right? Mm. So I would absolutely recommend it for
people.
Anyone.
That'll be an offshoot. It's an amazing thing from an actor doing philanthropy kind of work or philosophy, like you said. That's something I'll check out. What else? Movies, anything that you want to recommend?
I mean, not recently, not anyone's worth mentioning.
But you get to watch Netflix. That's your pastime.
Absolutely.
You browse
through
so many titles.
Yes.
So great. So I wish, you know, Breathe Capital, Cap Connect, all the best. And thanks for coming on the show. And we should do more of this and probably pick up some of your startups and bring them on board to the studio next time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We should do a nice meal together with the founders and and hopefully some drinks as well.
I look forward to it. Yeah. Thank you, Sharia.
Thank you, Sharia.
Thank you.